It's now 10:15. We'll call the Tax Committee to order, and will Representative Freiberg move the minutes from February 13th?
No. Just kidding. I always wanted to say that. Sure, I would gladly move the minutes.
Representative Freiberg moves the minutes from February 13th. Be approved. All in favor?
Aye.
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 All opposed? Fails. Today we're going to do a... Commissioner Marquardt's going to do a Department of Revenue presentation for the agency and the governor's proposal. And members, we are today going to ask questions during the testimony if you want to, and doing it afterwards. Commissioner Marquardt has welcomed questions during the testimony. So thank you. Thank you, Ms. Marquardt. State your name and thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I am Paul Marquardt, Commissioner of Revenue, and I'm joined here at the table by Lee Ho, who is the Deputy Commissioner, Madeline Clark, who is the Legislative Coordinator. And Mr. Chair, it's always great to be back to the best committee. So thank you very much.
Representative Marquardt, this might be history that I get to sit in the chair today, and I think out of my district, you were the chair of taxes at one time, correct?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, District 4B is well represented in this committee over the years. Yes, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Marquardt.
So I'm going to ask Madeline to move the, and I can't see either one of those, so I'm going to go off here a little bit, but I have them in front of me. So in the front there is the mission and the vision and the values, and it's always that vision one that always draws maybe the most debate and so forth, as everyone reports, pays and receives the right amount, no more and no less. If we move to the next one, a quick summary of the tax revenues that come in, about $33 billion come in every year to the state of Minnesota, the general fund primarily. And the revenue department manages, supervises, enforces, collects. And I wanted to mention that last bullet there, it's accomplished with an administrative cost of about 0.6%. So the annual budget of the Department of Revenue is about $200 million a year. So, I mean, just think back to other agencies and that when you look at administrative fees, sometimes it's 5 to 10%. The department is doing this at about 0.6%. And I will say that this isn't anything unique. This Department of Revenue, ever since I was in the legislature, 20-some years, independent, Republican, Democratic governors, administration, it doesn't matter. The department has always been run very efficiently. Next, tax aids and credits. The department sends out a lot of, and administers a lot of different aids and credits. This is not an entire list, but many of these I'm sure you are familiar with. Next slide, please. So services, this is the reason the state collects revenue and why it's important that you have a department that keeps track of all this, and that is so it can fund these very important services. Next slide, please. So we have a lot of different customers. So about 3.1 million individual income tax filers will file by the end of the year. And just some interesting notes, typically about 93-94% now file their taxes electronically, and about 75% do a direct deposit. As of last Friday, February 14th, there has been 475,000 returns, and 99.3% of them have been filed electronically at this point. And out of that 475,000, 240,000 refunds have gone out or are going to go out, and 96% of those refunds are doing direct deposit versus 75%. So the numbers are way high early on. And right now, those refunds are going out in 6.84 days. So in a week right now, the refunds are going out. And Still, the most convenient and secure way to file is electronically and then to take direct deposit. So I want to take you down to this third bullet, 800 licensed property tax assessors. That is a very important duty of the Department of Revenue, is that because property tax is the only tax where the government sets the amount or the value upon which the tax rate is applied. The government comes in and sets the value of your home. And so the Department of Revenue is responsible for approving all of the county assessors. And it is quite a process, which I'm very involved with. But there's several, you know, you can be on a probationary status. You can be, you know, where you meet the standard. And there is all sorts of different levels there to make sure that these assessors are doing a good job. And so there's a lot of scrutiny of our assessors throughout the state. If we can move to the next one. Other customers, certainly the governor and the legislature. Department of Revenue helps advise and make suggestions to the legislature and the governor. And one thing I'd like to say right here is that, you know, if you're thinking about a bill and it has tax implications, never hesitate to give us a call. We're not going to say one way or the other, but we can make sure that it can be administered, because one of the things you want is any tax bill or law to be able to be administered properly and efficiently and as simple as possible for the taxpayer, and we can certainly help you do that. So never hesitate to contact us if you're doing that. Next, more on who do we serve. This is more the tax committee support. As you know, we provide revenue estimates on what would be the cost of a particular tax item. The tax incident study also comes out once every 2 years and is a valuable resource to really look at where taxes fall on, and looks at regressivity or progressivity of a tax. Other reports do a lot on, of course, the valuations of property and sending out those reports. The BOSS report that tends to look at what percent of a person's income are you paying in property taxes and divides that up into all sorts of income deciles and regional levels. And then, of course, one that was just released last fall, the tax expenditure budget. Next slide, please. So this is just kind of a list of what the Department of Revenue does. And by the end of the tax filing year, about 3.1 million individual filers we will have returns from. And last year, there's about 2.2 million refunds. About 70% of the filers are getting refunds. There's also about 277,000 corporate returns that were filed last year also. So this kind of gives you an idea of the scope of the work that occurs. And the total is about 7.2 million tax returns and refunds each year. Next, if you would, Manny, thank you. So another big part of the Department of Revenue's function is to protect taxpayers. And that very first one, just on the average over the last couple years, the department has stopped about $30 million in fraudulent filed tax refunds before they went out the door. And the department does have a fraud unit that looks at analytics, looks at data, and looks for inconsistencies that might occur in the data that comes through in terms of the filing, but actually even how they file. And one of the big areas, especially on refunds, is identity theft, where they'll use the name of someone deceased or someone else and so forth. And so once the analytics will throw up a red flag, then this unit goes and investigates further. So I will say that in some years it's been much more than $30 million, but just kind of that is what you typically would see in fraudulent attempts. And then that second one, through audits, through collections, through criminal enforcement, this was last year's total. The department collected about $487 million of past due or overdue or weren't being paid taxes. And this include from local governments, too, where there might be that people aren't paying and so forth. So $487 million, that's about 1.5% of our annual revenues. It's significant, and that's collected. The year before it was about $360 million, but the last year was $487 million. And then last year, the fourth bullet down, we charged out 44 criminal tax fraud cases in court, and that recouped about $4.2 million. Next one, please. So voluntary compliance. We have a voluntary compliance tax system. Now, you might not think it's voluntary whether or not you pay your taxes or not. Of course, it isn't. But you rely on you or through your tax preparer or software vendor to file your taxes and sign off. And a huge key to a voluntary compliance and getting a high percent that we do in the state of Minnesota is people need to have the confidence that their data is being protected and secured. That is huge. And so we spend a lot of time, as you'll see later, protecting that data to make sure that folks don't get a hold of that. And so a large part of that is going through training and outreach events. As you can see here, lots of things on outreach to get out to customers. You know, if you have a new program, like this year, we have the renter's refund is moving to the renter's credit. So get out that information, you know, to rental owners, but also to the renters, that now you can file that on your property taxes. Or, excuse me, file that when you file your income taxes. And then last year we had the child tax credit, which was a new program, and a huge amount of outreach took place on that through the governor and lieutenant governor, through other agencies, through advocates and so forth. And in the end, we got about 87% participation on the child tax credit. It was about 224,000 families out of about, we think, about 566,000 that were eligible. So 87% is pretty high when a lot of other programs are maybe around 80% or lower, long-established programs. But we always try to get 100%. If you got a program out there, you want to make sure that folks benefit from that. And that's why if you can make the administration, as I mentioned earlier, as easy and simple as possible, that also helps participation in any program. Next one, community and taxpayers. I guess I got a little bit ahead of myself, but just again, talking about new programs and how you can get information out. The second bullet there, we also have offices within the Department of Revenue that work with and assist taxpayers, Office of Public Engagement, also the Taxpayer Rights Advocate, which really kind of works independent of anything else. So if you've gone through the process at the Department of Revenue and you just aren't being satisfied to what you think this issue should be, you can go to the Taxpayers Rights Office, kind of the last resort in the Department of Revenue. And so when they look at certain situations, they don't just deal with it one-on-one. They also look at, are there some consistent things that are coming up here that people are having problems with? And we can go back then and correct this. Hey, yes, this seems to be a problem that the taxpayers' rights advocates seen, and let's try to correct that. So they look at some common themes that can be corrected. Administering the tax code. As you know, there are many different tax types, and this is what you see here is probably only about a third of them. So none of the motor vehicle or sales or fuels excise tax, I don't think, is there. I guess we have petroleum and insurance premiums, so there's other ones. Those are some of the major different types of taxes that are administered. All right, tax administration. So, again, here's our priorities. A big one is in enhancing the simplicity and transparency for taxpayers. That's really important. Supporting the voluntary compliance, assisting when we can, and also making sure we protect the integrity of the tax system, which makes sure that people have faith and confidence in what we're doing. So we take that very seriously. The tax administration cycle, not going to go over that in detail, but the first step is really the engage. And so you engage with stakeholders, you know, see what their needs are, and this could be your tax preparers, could be advocates, whoever that might be. We then would go to the governor or the legislature for recommendations that we think meet what people have been talking about. We inform, make sure folks know their obligations under the law. Then we process, as filing comes in, we process that $33 billion of revenue coming in. We audit to assure we're collecting the right amount, no more, no less. And then if we still haven't got money from folks that may owe, that's the collection part in enforcement. So you can certainly look at that later at your convenience. The next one here is a little bit of a timeline. And you notice our chart starts in May. That's because January through May, a few big things are occurring. The legislative session for one, and this is really the big, busy tax filing season. So after the legislature ends its session in May, we then will start to synthesize and look at all of the law changes. And in fact, this was where it says synthesized law changes. That's where we found that error on the standard deduction a couple of years that we corrected in 24. We corrected that. That's kind of where we found that. And then we begin to take all these changes. We begin to update the tax forms. We develop, change the tax forms. After the 23 session, over 300 tax forms and instructions had to be changed. You then, in August, publish the near final forms, and then you do basically the tax processing system testing, and I'll take you through that next slide. So this kind of covers from August to the end, but the Minnesota Department of Revenue is doing a lot of testing. In fact, internal testing, you see that there's about 67,000 internal tests that are done, and this is done through our Gentax system. The Gentax system is the big computer software that generates it, takes in the returns and programs and all that, and we have to make sure that all the processing rules, all the calculation rules, all the testing schemes and so forth are all working, and that actually took about 67,000 individual little tests. Another 2,500 tests, making sure things are working back and forth with the IRS. On that second line there, the software providers are also doing testing that we're working with them. And I will say that even after all of that, usually the first day of filing or so, there's a few little tweaks we still need to make, either with a vendor that hasn't quite updated or something. There's always just a couple. But we catch them early on. But just even with all of that, some things are usually needed to be tweaked a little bit. And here's the processing. I don't know if there's much to add there that you can look at that later. But again, historically, about 93 or 94% are now doing the electronic filing versus, 5 or 6% for paper. This year, it's like 99% right now. And then if you get to the very bottom of that, on the left side, you've got direct deposit, typically about 75%, but right now it's like at 96% early on in the filing season. Oh, I was going to mention, too, that the busiest week of the year, or weekend of the year for the Department of Revenue, is April 15th, around that time. The second busiest weekend was this last weekend, President's Day weekend. And I was hoping to have, I didn't have the data yet as how many, but usually people who are getting refunds will file early, and maybe this is to get a day off. But this is typically the second busiest weekend of the year. And maybe the next time I come back, I'll give you a number of how many there was. I couldn't get that yet today. But. Revenue operations, then improving the customer experience through technology, going to e-services, you can go to your cell phone. We're working to take going by stages, but ultimately you'll be able to make payments, do correspondence, check your balance, all those type of things on e-services. Chatbot is something we're using, of course. We're not doing generative AI because we don't trust it to give you the proper tax data. So it is whatever is the opposite, the generative, is what we're using. We're actually, you have questions, we actually will have a canned response. But we're not letting generative AI do that work. We just can't chance that. But we do use that speeds things up. We have automatic translation. Spanish, Hmong,
Somali. Commissioner Marker, we got one question.
I'm sorry. Yes.
Here, thank you, Chair Joy, and thanks, Commissioner Marquardt. I just had a question because, I go to these like fiscal and tax national conferences sometimes. I went to a couple of them in the last couple of years, and they were talking about different departments of state departments of revenue using AI to track, not using generative AI chatbots to interact with customers, but sort of more like applications in auditing complex returns and tracking. There was sort of like patterns that they could kind of use this technology to track. And so I'm just wondering if you guys are using AI in any of those ways. Our Chair Davids's counterpart in the Senate, Chair Rest has a lot of interest in this, so maybe I'm asking this on her behalf, but curious if you guys are using AI in your kind of back of house operations right now.
Mr. Chair, I'll have Mr. Ho answer that.
Chair, Representative Gomez, we are also following and monitoring that trend from other states, and we are looking at it. We're not currently using it in a form that would be at the sort of higher level. I think we've used some data analytics tools to help us monitor activity, but I wouldn't necessarily call it in the artificial intelligence space at this point in time. But it is something that we are monitoring and we're aware is something that is a growing possibility. So it's something we're looking at.
Thank you.
Thank you. Continue.
Very good. I think we can move to the next one. Some efficiencies in managing costs. Contact center enhancements technology allows us to handle more calls with less people, certainly. Increased use of AI, as we just mentioned, to answer basic questions. And we are shrinking our physical space, and that's about 35% since 2020, which saves about $2.4 million a year. The next one, we're spending a slide just on this because it's really, really important, but securing taxpayer information is everyone's job at the Department of Revenue. There are a number of things we have because we have employees that, of course, are dealing with personal tax information every day, including federal tax information every day. So besides training, which is integral, there are a number of things set up, and each employee has a state-issued computer. But there's all sorts of, as you see, virtual private networks, multi-factor authentication. That integrated tax system controls, we have supervisors that can monitor what each of the employees are seeing on their screens to prevent what we call browsing. Browsing would be an employee looking at someone's tax data, not being authorized to do so. And we, that's up to dismissal if you were to do something like that. So we watch that very, very carefully. And again, when you have a voluntary compliance, folks are looking at this very closely. They and that's why we have other agencies that will create bills that will want data from the Department of Revenue. And we're always very leery of that, just because the taxpayer, when they're filing their taxes, are under the assumption that their data is going to be protected and private. And so even giving it to other agencies, and there are situations where we do, under law and so forth, but we're always very protective of that and always want to find
out. Excuse me, Commissioner Markert, lead. Gomez.
Sorry. Thank you, Chair Joy and Commissioner. And I just think in the current moment, it's particularly important that we highlight this point that the Commissioner is making right now. The integrity of our revenue system relies on people's understanding and belief that their private, their identifying information will be kept private. You know, the commissioner just talked about this, and I have a couple of constituents who are revenue employees who made this point to me that I hadn't really thought about, you know, just how much our collective understanding about the safety of our data kind of holds up the revenue system, and that it's like, from the employee perspective, I guess I'll share, it is 100% known to every person who works at revenue that there is like zero tolerance for misuse of people's personal identifying information. The commissioner just talked about how people have been terminated for misusing that information. And I'll just say, as somebody, you know, who works in this space, it's why I am so deeply concerned about what is happening with people's data at the federal level. And we're hearing, you know, now about the compromises that were made to the Treasury payment system, which includes, you know, data that's held by the department or by the IRS nationally. And, you know, and now hearing about, you know, sort of unaccountable, I don't even know what you call the young Doge boys. They're not even unaccountable bureaucrats, because there actually is accountability for bureaucrats. As we've heard, up to and including termination for misuse of personal identifying information. But we should all be really concerned about what is happening with people's PII at the federal level, and it really relates to our conversations in this committee, because, you know, our Department of Revenue can do everything that they possibly can, and they do, to protect people's information. But if the information at the federal level and at the IRS is not secure, then no taxpayer in Minnesota can rest easy about their information being secure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Markert, continue. Do you have a question?
No, that's it. I was just wanting to go on that little rant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I figured I'd jump in with my IT question while we're on the topic. I noticed that you were saying that you repelled about, I can't remember how many hits on your system. Do you use Minute for the cybersecurity for watching over, or do you have an internal one?
Commissioner Markert.
Mr. Chair, Representative Joachim, I'll have Mr. Hull answer that.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, we do work with Minute on cybersecurity, and they are the they provide us great assistance and are a good partner for that.
Thank you.
Commissioner Marker.
Yeah, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hold deals with the technical aspects, and is on the technical committee that works on all that. So I want to make sure you get the right answer, all of that. So, yeah, I mean, so getting here, we are always are very concerned about making sure we don't erode confidence in people's ability to know that they're tax data is private and secure, so we take all of these precautions in order when we're doing this. So next one, employees' roles. There's lots of job opportunities at the Department of Revenue, as you can see there. Department of Revenue has about 1,400 employees, give or take, depending on the time of the year and so forth. But lots of different job descriptions there. Next, one thing that we're really proud about is that the Department of Revenue reflects and represents all of Minnesota. So there's, out of the 1,400 total employees, about 280 or 20% work in live and work in Greater Minnesota, in 44 of the 80 Greater Minnesota counties. And so as you look at the map, in the green there, you can see counties that have employees of the Department of Revenue. You can see if you check out Clay County that no nepotism is taking place here. There is not a single employee. As someone here at Revenue said, maybe they know who the commissioner is and don't want to work for that person. So at any rate, I wanted to make that note. But, you know, I remember as a legislator where there used to be bills to, like, move the Department of Agriculture out to rural Minnesota, basically to bring jobs out there. And, you know, the situation right now is, you know, this allows jobs to come out to rural Minnesota. And then finally, the other agency partners, and this is not an exhaustive list, but Minute with data security, reporting and forecasting with MMB. I think the one you'll maybe find interesting, which I did, was Employment and Economic Development sends out, does the checks, prints the checks. So like for refunds and like the advanced child tax credit that will go out, it's not the Department of Revenue that sends out those, prints the checks. It's Employment and Economic Development actually prints those checks. Yes, it was to me also. So, Mr. Chair and members, that's the presentation. Certainly up to any questions, but it's an honor and pleasure to be able to serve this committee and the House of Representatives and the people.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Hewitt has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. Just a couple, two different questions, but one is about returns. Recently, I had the privilege of working at a shelter, and I was talking to some of the clients, and they're always looking for low-hanging fruit for any kind of income, and there was a tax preparer there, too, and I said, so what happens if they don't have a bank account or a place to cash a check that's not going to charge a ridiculous fee? Do we have any systems that help anybody like that, or is there any systems out there that you can refer them to?
Commissioner Marquardt.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hewitt, that's a really good question that I don't know if I know the answer to, but I don't know.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hewitt, I don't know that we have that answer today, but what I would recommend is if someone's in that situation, they call the Taxpayer Rights Advocate's office, and they will help facilitate the transaction that they need.
Mr. Chair, just a quick follow-up. So, yeah, and that, just, you know, I know people that are in that situation that are just, they're at their wit's end, and I was real curious what we looked at. Even $10 means a lot to them. So there is a taxpayer advocacy organization, but we even give them a paper check to no address is also an issue, is what I was hearing from this individual too. So thank you for that. And then one more question, Mr. Chair, if I may.
Go ahead, Representative Hugh.
This is more complex and might be controversial, so I got to be careful on this one. All these income earners that live in Wisconsin but work in Minnesota, do we get a clip of that income, or does it all go back to they refile here and then goes over to Wisconsin and we're out of the game? Just curious.
Commissioner Marquardt.
So thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hewitt. Back a few years ago, back that was Chair David's bill that created where there's a credit of Wisconsin taxes paid back and forth. And so just recently, the Wisconsin Assembly or legislature requested a study to look at a tax reciprocity, which we used to have with Wisconsin and no longer have that. The net result on the study is that we gain a lot more dollars from Wisconsin than they would gain from us, I think, if I remember the study and so forth, by quite a bit. So they would like to actually look at reciprocity again. It was stopped in about, oh, I think Governor Plenty was the governor at the time, and there was some, Wisconsin was behind on some payments, so they ended up kind of stopping the reciprocity agreement at that time. But they would like to look at starting that again. But we're not pursuing that, but we were part of the study that their legislature did approve.
Well, Mr. Chair, if we have a net gain, I'm just going to drop my questions.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner Marquardt. Always wonderful to see you and have you in committee. I wanted to just go back to the slide on page 10 where you talked about the good work that your department does on tracking fraudulently filed returns. And you mentioned that the unit uses analytics to kind of flag unusual returns or maybe tracking if people are eligible or maybe passed away or whatever. I wondered if you could just say a little bit more about that. And then there was $33 million in fraud. I'm assuming these are 2024 data.
Commissioner Marquardt.
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Robbins, so $30 million was an average between 22 and 23, I think. I don't think we have the latest one on 24. But I will tell you, and I didn't use this number, that one year, and we didn't put this in here, it was over $200 million that was stopped going out the door on the homestead credit state refund. And it was just out of the ordinary. So I didn't include that in there, but it was huge. And we knew about it early on. We started, and it was a concerted effort on this ID theft and so forth. And well, but that's unusual, but it was kind of a concerted effort there. So I don't know what the analytics are, and even if I did, I couldn't share those because we don't want folks to know what are the red flags. And so as I've talked with folks in that unit, I purposely told them not to give me the red flags. But what they were saying is that it's really inconsistencies that they're looking at. So they'll look at like a return from the year before that might have done the homestead credit state refund. And this year it's a little different. Even how it's filed could be different between electronic or paper or whatever. And so they're looking for, and then the analytics will look at, so if your refund was a certain amount one year and it's way up the next year or something, that would, create something. But I didn't want to get into, and I didn't ask them for any more details than that, but so I don't know for sure what are the analytics.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt, and I completely respect that, but I may do some follow-up with your staff. But then the next question I have is, I'm not sure if this is 23 or 24, but there were 44 criminal tax fraud cases. So of the $30 million in fraud you stopped from going out the door, how many of those were prosecuted? It seems like 44 is a small number compared to $30
million. Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Robbins, yeah, I could not tell you that. I don't know how many of when we stop these that are actually go to court because it's, we're stopping the refund from going out, and I don't know how much goes further than that and how many of them actually go to court. I'd have to find that out. I don't have that number.
Representative Roberts.
Thank you. I would love to see that if someone could find that for me. Thank you.
Good question. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question about what is the status of free e-filing for lower income individuals? Is that all operational and easy to use at this point?
Commissioner Marquardt.
Mr. Chair, Representative Elkins, are you talking about the direct file for the So when we go over the governor's budget, I do cover that if you want. Is that all right?
That's fine.
I think we can talk about that a little bit more. Yeah.
Any other questions on this before we move to the governor's budget? Thank you, Commissioner Marquardt. Let's move to the governor's budget.
Thank you.
Thank you. Everyone, there is a spreadsheet in the pack that non-part has included also. If you want to follow along that. So. Commissioner Markwart.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm proud to be able to present the governor's budget as it pertains to the tax provisions in the budget. And the Governor Walz, Lieutenant Governor Flanagan, this is their budget. And I kind of put the whole budget here on this first slide because the tax provisions in this budget work in tandem with the rest of the budget. And it's responsible, it's measured, it's a thoughtful approach on how can we really try to balance that structural deficit. And that's the real key in the governor's budget, solves about 50% of that. But also how to protect important investments that were made and how to protect those into the future. And the final bullet on this first slide is creating more fairness and stability in the tax code. And so that's what I will talk about here. All right. So the major item in Governor Walz's and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan's tax provisions is cutting the sales tax rate and expanding the base. It's a long overdue improvement to the sales tax code. And before I go into the details, just like to talk about what are the benefits when you can cut the rate and expand the base. So number one is it creates more tax fairness for consumers and businesses because we already are taxing a lot of services, lawn care, laundry, building cleaning, security, pet grooming, towing, all sorts of services we already. So it helps level the playing field in that regard. Another big benefit is that it really right-sizes the tax code to a more service-orientated economy. So back in 1967, when we initiated the sales tax at 3%, about 60% of our economy were goods, which is taxed, and 40% services. And we tax mainly goods. Well, today that is really kind of flip-flopped. And so you are taxing a narrower portion of the economy, which, you know, increases the rate that you have to enact to get to the same amount. It also, because the sales tax, unlike income tax and corporate tax, is a more stable type of tax, that anytime you can expand that, you're creating a more stable tax system into the future. And finally, there's a lot of evidence and literature and studies that expanding the sales tax to services tends to make it less regressive. We know it's regressive, and by doing this doesn't make it progressive, but it does, at least the literature, strong evidence that makes it less regressive. Next, so here are the details for this. It decreases the state sales tax rate from 6.5 to 6.425. It cuts it by 0.075%. And for the consumer, it's 6.875 down to 6.8 because you have that legacy amendment of 0.375, which does not change. So you really tax that main 6.5 down to.
Mr. Chair. Just a question.
Representative Swinson.
When it comes to the arts and crafts part of the amendment, does that expand to the other items as well? Thank you.
Commissioner Markwart.
Mr. Chair and Representative Swinson, yes, it does. And in the financial spreadsheet that you have, you can kind of see what that expansion is. So it doesn't change the rate, but it does expand and would bring in some more dollars, absolutely. So this would be, if enacted, the first sales tax rate cut in state history. It expands to many professional services. So it's legal, it's banking, brokerage, and accounting. And so that hits. Now there are some carve-outs. So if you are filing for the child tax credit or the working family credit, that would still be tax exempt. That would not be taxable. Certain pensions would not be taxable. Their loan origination fees or overdrafts or late fees also would not be taxable, and legal aid would not be taxable, still be exempt. One major component of this is that business-to-business taxes, sales remain exempt. So if you are a farmer and you are hiring an accountant to do your farm operation books, that is still tax exempt. If I am a business manufacturer and I hire an attorney to look at some things, that's business to business, that still is tax exempt. But that business would see the reduction benefit of the sales tax on the goods that it purchases if it's not business related. So the reason we avoid that is because anytime you do business, the business sales taxes, you start to tax inputs and production, which tends to get passed down to the consumer in layered invisible costs, or in tax parlance, we call that tax pyramiding. So this does not do any of that. It would be effective for sales after September 30th, and the net.
Mr. Markhart, one
yes.
moment.
Oh, sorry. Thank you, Chair Joy. So just to go back to the second bullet, so child tax credit and working family credit tax filers are on the list of exemptions. But so is that, that's just for professional services related to claiming those credits?
Commissioner Markhart.
Chair, Representative Gomez. So that would be, so the governor extends the sales tax to accountants. But if you are filing for the child tax credit or working family credit, they would not charge you any sales tax. Sales tax is exempt. And so, yes.
Thank you, Chair.
And the big reason is we don't want to provide any obstacles at all or hindrance for those filing for those.
That's why I said so.
Thank you.
Roughly.
Thank you, Chair Joy. I thought we would know each other better because we've served on this committee for 2 years and we're the only ones with three-letter last names. But thank you, Chair. So I actually wanted to go back to this second bullet, too, and I guess I'm learning here something, maybe, and I don't know if this is a question for the commissioner or maybe for Mr. Clayman, but when I'm reading the second bullet, does this mean that when banks collect like overdraft fees and late fees, are we not taxing them for like that revenue that they get from people who overdraft?
Mr. Markhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lee. So right now, that would not be taxable. Now, the expansion would make it, well, normally if we weren't carving this out, that would be taxable, but we're carving that out. So we're saying out of the expansion to banking professional services, if you have late charges, overdraft, or loan origination fees, those would still be exempt. We're carving those out of this expansion.
Okay.
Representative Lee.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I'm just, I mean, it blows my mind that people are still paying this to banks and they are not being taxed for it, and they will remain not taxed for it when this proposal is enacted. Yeah, okay.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. Maybe I can clarify. So those are fees that's income earned to a bank, and the bank pays income taxes on its earnings. So that's a different thing than a sales tax on a fee. So they're two very different things. But I guess my question to the commissioner, but 8 cents on $100 is not a tax cut. So I feel bad that you're in your shoes having to, argue that this tax cut, it's tax increase on certain services. Why were those particular services chosen and, to increase taxes? And can you talk a little bit about compliance? Because let's talk about, an average accounting firm. So my guess is that most of their income is actually derived from business accounting, versus personal accounting, a firm versus like an online thing, which taxes individuals, or their income is derived from individuals. And can you explain why those things are chosen? And am I right that that let's say an online tax tiger or whatever these tax online tax things, so that is to an individual that that would now have this 8 or 8.5% sales tax because of all the lease in the metro, all of the extra taxes in the metro, that they would, the person that would use these online tax tools would be taxed now on their taxes.
Commissioner Marquardt.
Preparation, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, so a couple questions there. So the first one is why were these professional services selected? So when you look at not county business to business, we're actually, that's where much of like four, just if you go to page 150 of the tax expenditure report, it kind of lists selected business to business, but also then consumer. And business to business, like $4.8 billion. And the consumer is like 650 million small right. percent. So we're just on the consumer side. And there's four main areas out of the kind of the consumer portion that services that haven't been taxed yet. It's professional, it's personal care, it's funeral and automotive repair. And so the professional ones, as the governor looked at that, they, you know, if you look, if you go to the Bureau of Labor Statistics and look at what's called kind of job wages report that they have, and I'm using 2023. If you're an attorney, that average is about 176,000. All the other ones, bankers, brokerage, accountants, are like 75,000 or more. If you go to personal care, the average is like 35,000. If you go to automotive, it's like 51,000. So the point to be made here is that in legal and some of these other professional ones, you really have maybe more capacity to adjust your what you end up charging the consumer. There may be more wiggle room there than someone that has, on the average, a lot lower of an income. So that's kind of one thing to look at that. The second thing is, you know, architectural, engineering, advertising, those are some professional services that were not selected, and they have more business to business than they probably do kind of on the consumer, and that was another area. But you notice there isn't the personal care. The automotive was not selected. And, you know, the idea for the governor and lieutenant governor is these are ones that probably have more wiggle room than others to be able to adjust what they pass on to the consumer. And the second question?
Ben Anderson, did you have that second question for him?
I do. It's a different one. has there been discussion? So my, I suspect that this side of the aisle is not going to support any tax increases when this is a big sales tax increase. Has there been some other discussion about other ways to balance the budget besides tax increases?
Commissioner Marquardt.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, this really gets to kind of the crux of everything. So the rate cut alone is about a $95 million cut in the first full year. Adding the expanded services is an increase of about 210. So the net is about a $115 million increase. I will say that the average family will see a cut of about $37, which is about 1.8% of their sales tax. And many residents will see a tax cut. Many will see a tax cut depending on how often you use these expanded services. And if you're an average family, if you spend $550 or less on any of these expanded services, you know, legal, brokerage, banking, or accounting, you will see a tax cut because that $37 is the sales, you know, $550 on, you'll see a tax cut. So just put yourself in that situation and you can determine. But many are going to see a tax cut on this. So overall, does it raise revenue when you put the net? Yes, it does. But remember, this is part of the overall governor's budget. And in 28-29, which is really the important year when we look at solving the structural deficit, The governor's plan cuts $1.9 billion. This, over this biennium's about 230 or 40. There are $8 of cuts in the governor's budget to $1 of revenue increases here in this tax proposal. And the governor also uses this revenue to fund some other things, like the research and development credit that's in this bill, the enhancement of the sustainable aviation credit, the fraud prevention, other types of things. So it's all part of the budget here, and that's why there's a, you know, in the whole budget, the whole scheme of things, there's a small part of increase in revenues. Yes, there is.
Thank you. But I remember. I remembered my question. TurboTax, so accounting services, that was it. So the individual that uses TurboTax, they're going to be now pay sales taxes on that, and then at the full 8.5% rate, all of a sudden it becomes taxable. So it's not just the general, but it's all the local option sales taxes too. Is that correct? Yeah.
So Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, if you buy a prepackaged software, that is already taxable. So if I purchase if I go online and if it is a service, what's the word I'm looking for? It's software as a service.
Right.
Then right now it is not taxable. So that would be taxable, I think, at this point. So the prepackage is already taxable. The software as a service right now probably is not taxable, depending on how the setup is.
Okay. Thank you.
And Representative Hoyt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hewitt. But anyways, you're not the only one. Trust me. Chair, Representative, I'm sorry.
Commissioner.
There we go.
Old habits die hard.
It's age, right? So the question I have, and I'm getting overwhelmed with calls from realtors that are concerned about the banking service fees on title services, closing companies, mortgage stuff. I keep saying I don't believe that's the intent of the proposal, but maybe you can put it at rest and concur with me and we'll be done.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Hewitt, so again, if it's anything to do with business to business, it's tax exempt still. If it's like you're talking business is hiring an attorney or anything like that. But, you know, loan origination fees, which usually can be, you know, $600 to $1,200, whatever, that is tax exempt. That's been carved out. So, you know, you're looking at mortgage. I mean, that's initially that's a cost right there. And so, you know, if you look at banking, it's account maintenance fees, loan servicing, payment services, safety deposit boxes would be areas under there that would be taxable now.
And Mr. Chair, so Commissioner Marquardt, so the title services, closing fees, stuff like that are not part of this proposal. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hewitt, I don't see that. And, you know, when we have the language on the bill, you know, we'd be able to, but I'd have to get back to you for sure on that. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner.
Next, we got Representative Harder.
Thank you, Chair Joy. Commissioner, keeping with that second bullet, the governor does have quite the wish list. Right now it is just a wish list. Personally, I really don't prefer to broaden the tax base. I've come more from the line that we are overtaxed. We need to lower the amount for everybody. And sometimes I think the state of Minnesota has a spending problem that needs to be addressed. And I think you just went over a couple of items, but I was zeroing in on the bank service. You know, what kind of a bank service would consumers have to pay? So like if there's an older couple that needs help balancing their checkbook, would they be subject to a tax on that if it takes an hour or two?
Commissioner Marquardt.
Mr. Chair and Representative Harder, I would think, yeah, that would be taxable.
Representative Harder.
Thank you, Chair Joy. My next question, before I get back to that, would these consumers now be subject to the additional sales tax from the state? Are they also going to be required the additional sales tax from county and city taxes?
Commissioner Marker.
Mr. Chair, Representative Harder, that's a great question I should have covered earlier. So the rate change here does not impact any of the local sales taxes. So any of those metro area sales taxes does not impact.
Representative Harder.
Right, just one comment on about the question I had with probably people that are on fixed incomes, maybe lower. Could be other people that are getting services from their bank, you know, help balancing their checkbook, whatever the case might be. I think is a little concerning, especially if they're on fixed incomes, because this would just be an added fee, if you want to call it. You can call it a tax. It's a fee that many people would enjoy that they get from their bank. And I would request that such those items, maybe the brokerage one, maybe there's an elderly couple I'm thinking of that go to their broker to find out where they are, and then they're being going to subject to another tax. And so that's just concerning to me. Thank you.
Commissioner Chair and Representative Harder. So one thing that I think is important is that one of the main purposes of the governor's proposal here is to protect investments that were made. And when we talk about senior citizens on fixed income, the 2023 tax bill provided in this next biennium, 26-27, about $577 million of tax cuts. In the form of reducing the amount of Social Security benefits that are taxed. So if you're now a couple, a senior couple, 108,000 income, there's no tax on your Social Security. So while, yes, there, as you mentioned there, there could be some increases, we have to remember a big part of this budget is really protecting those investments that were made. And, you know, I could go on. There's a number of property tax relief expansions that were made in 23 that also will help senior citizens in their homes and in, as a renter. So important to kind of keep everything in mind as we look at the totality of what this bill does.
Commissioner Marker, just to be clear, will these services be subject to local sales tax?
Oh, Mr. Chair, yes, they will. So while the rate will not change, a city that now has a local sales tax will bring in more revenue every year than they otherwise would be.
Any other questions? Lee Gomez.
Thank you, Chair Joy. I'm just trying to scroll through my tax expenditure budget here, and I haven't found it yet. But I'm just curious about these bank services. I'm not sure what kind of bank service would be charging someone for helping balance their checkbook for 2 hours. I'm not familiar with that service. What I did notice previously in the tax expenditure budget, I believe, were things like brokerage fees, fees related to administering trusts, fees related to safe deposit boxes being exempt. And I'm wondering if you can just speak a little bit more. If anybody knows about that kind of service, please explain to me what it actually is about where you go to a bank and they help you balance your checkbook. And secondly, can you speak to whether those I'm not sure if that's exactly the list. I'm kind of pulling it out of my mind in terms of some of those banking-related services that are currently tax-exempt. If you could just kind of unpack what those services are a little bit more specifically for us. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Marquardt.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gomez, so, I mean, I think every bank's going to be a little different. Yeah, I don't know if they would charge for helping set up a checking account or not. But, I mean, all those things that you listed would be taxable under the expansion. Now, exactly what those charges are or how they that might differ for every bank, I'm not quite sure. But those would be included. There's kind of a category that combines brokerage and banking, you know, and a lot of it's a lot of wealth management, managing investment funds, managing mutual funds, those type of things. So any of those charges would now be taxable under the expansion.
Yeah, thanks, Chair Joy. So if you get charged a monthly fee just like for administering a checking account or something, would that be taxed under the governor's proposal?
Commissioner Mr. Chair, Representative Gomez, I think yes, it would.
Okay, thank you. And I'll just speak for myself. I don't think I've ever incurred, like, outside of, you know, in my youth, maybe some overdraft fees, I haven't really incurred charges from a bank for just doing, like, regular kind of day-to-day stuff. But if that's happening, somebody please let me know.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Chair. And Chair Marquardt, maybe just to build a little bit on Chair Gomez's question, I have been meeting with quite a few banks and financial institutions who are actually really worried about having checking accounts and savings accounts be charged. I think that we've tried to get away from the days of which people were being charged monthly fees for just having accounts, and I think that that disproportionately impacts people from who are from low-income communities, and they were talking about how there would be concerns of the bank industry charging people to have accounts again. And so I'm wondering if maybe that's just something that your team and the governor could just sort of think through, that within bank services, they're not sort of all the same. And so I don't know what that would look like or what the governor would entertain, but I do worry about banks going back to the times in which they would charge fees just to have accounts and charge it monthly. I know that no, and banks are telling me they don't do this now, but that could go back to having that be an issue.
Mr. Marquardt.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hurd, no, thank you. And, you know, the governor, Tenet governor, certainly always look at things, you know, and as we go through the process here. But I mean, I think a lot of these, I think, may differ between banks on whether or not they're charged or not. Like Representative Gomez just said, after all of this came through, I looked at everything I spend with banking, accountant, and all this, and I would see a tax cut under this. I shouldn't say this. It's not self-serving, but I would see a tax cut. I look at my banking. I don't really – I mean, I'm kind of simple on things I do, but I don't see a lot from my bank as far as kind of charges that I'm getting right now. But anyway, the bottom line, yes, certainly governor would be willing to certainly listen in as we move this forward, certainly.
Representative Herr.
Thank you, Chair and Commissioner. I would just encourage, I do know that when, you know, having been in the financial services industry for the first part of my career, we do charge people who usually have lower balances fees to have their accounts. And like, if you're somebody who has a higher income, usually you have like check-free banking, and so it's not always available. So I think that we would be charging those who might be the most vulnerable. So I think it would be something worth taking a look at. Like those of us who don't see fees, there's a reason why we don't. And so if we're trying to protect the most vulnerable Minnesotans, we should really look at some of the specific services that banks do provide people.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hurd, thank you so much. And you can see the carve-outs we already have are, you know, looking at where it might hit people the hardest. So thank you for that. And that certainly meets the concept of what we're trying to do here with these carve-outs. So thank you.
Lead Gomez.
Thank you, Chair Joy and Commissioner. So I just found my little entry in the tax expenditure budget. And I just want to say that, like, it is, you know, I appreciate this proposal from the governor. It is the kind of a principle of a good tax system, as Chair Stevenson pointed out in our first meeting, to expand, to have a broad base and a low rate, sort of just like the kind of the what on a bipartisan basis we should sort of be building toward. It's the way to have a more kind of easy to administer system, a system that has less fluctuation or less volatility in it. And so some of these fees, this is in on page 150 of the tax expenditure budget, bank service charges trust services, safe deposit box rental, that's worth 20 or so million a year. Brokerage charges and investment counseling are worth 30 to 35, 38, 40 million a year. And so, you know, the other thing that I just want to say that I appreciate about this proposal that the governor has brought forward, and I think that we need to incorporate Chair Herr's concerns about having sort of more regular bank fees included in this. And I'm interested, even in the tax expenditure budget, about the why those trust services, safe deposit boxes, and regular bank fees are on the same line, because I think that who pays them is very different, to Chair Herr's point. But that what I appreciate about this proposal about broadening the sales tax base into services, and the thought that was put into it by the administration, is that if you look through that list of services that are tax exempt in the tax expenditure budget, there's really an attempt here to zero in on those expanding the sales tax to those services that low-income people just don't use, and that really like would increase the the progressivity of what is otherwise a regressive tax, the sales tax. And so I just wanted to say that I really appreciate the care and thought that's gone into this, and look forward to continuing that conversation about how it is that we have sort of more fair and equitable and easy to administer and easy to understand tax system moving forward. So thanks, Mr. Chair.
Members, one thing to remember too, we will be hearing this in committee again to do a deeper dive into this. So this is just an overview, but Rep. Roberts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Chair Marquardt. I appreciate this conversation a lot, and I looked ahead in the slides, and I don't see a full list of what will be now newly taxed. That's something you can provide for us, because we're talking about all these different fees and safety deposit boxes and all these things, but I think it would be helpful to be able to see the comprehensive list of what will be now covered under this tax.
Mr. Chair and Representative Robbins, and especially when you see the language of the bill, I've seen a draft as it lists a lot, and I we've got a list that we could provide certainly too, so thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. One I was questioning, and maybe this got covered, I know a lot of different services got brought up, but what about cash or check cashing services, where you just take somebody just got paid for the day or whatever and took their check in to one of those places and cash their check, would that be taxed?
Mm-hmm. Commissioner Marquardt.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, I mean, if there is a charge to that, to do that, I think it could fall into this, mm-hmm. Yes.
And from my understanding, it's a pretty hefty charge from what people have told me, which if you want to start going back into if this is regressive or not, I would say people that take their check don't have a bank account and just go in and get it cashed every time, every weekday that they're working, would be exactly the people you would not want to take extra money out of their bank account. Because if you go in for 100, walk away, I don't know what the latest fee is, but I was told it's not, they make money somehow, you'd want to not be taking another few dollars out of whatever fee they got charged. So that's what interesting how that would affect them. So thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. And I have a request as we continue to talk about this at the next hearing. I'm Chris from Nonpartisan. So what the budget here looks at is just the general fund budget. But if you broaden the sales tax to all these other services, it's going to be taxable period with all the sales taxes, not just the state sales tax, but your county sales taxes, the new, you know, housing sales tax, the local sales taxes, so all of these things. So it's a much higher percent than the, you know, the 6.5, 8 or whatever, or that, you know, one-tenth of 1% that's lower. So I think we should, it would be good for us to have the information about what this means to an average person as a taxpayer, you know, not just what the dollar difference is on the general fund, because that's what we need to be looking at, is the taxes that people are paying, you know, period, because it will be a big increase to locals, I think. Locals and counties and, you know, the Met Council and the other funds that are funded through taxes. So that would be great if we could get that information from nonpartisan as members. Thanks.
Perfect. Thank you. Anyone else? Commissioner Marquardt, if you want to continue the budget.
Yeah, thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. You know, one thing to remember, too, is that a business who is constructing a new home, all of the lumber, all of the supplies, all of that is going to see the sales tax rate cut. And so there's a lot of savings on the business side that also is going to get passed down to the consumer also. So we're going to move here to currently tax services in Minnesota. I'm not going to go over this, but you can take a look at some of the other ones. You know, we're hitting people right now in tough situations. If you have a storm come through your property and it blows down trees and that, to have those trees cleaned up and that is taxable. If you go into the ditch on a cold, wintry day, when you get towed out, that's taxable. If your building suffers water damage from either a flood or a fire, and putting it out, that's all taxable. Traffic control at a funeral is taxable. So, you know, and again, one of the big parts of this is creating a little more fairness among services. And of course, you know, you're going to hear from folks that we're expanding this to, but we already have expanded it to already that list of services that you see. So we'll move on. So the next thing is expanding the research and development credit. The governor in meetings with business leaders heard loud and clear this was a top priority. And so what this does, it makes the R&D tax credit partially refundable, 25%. From 2010 to 2012, it was refundable, and it hasn't been since 2012. This makes it partially refundable. And then the third bullet, there was an OLA report in 2017, and this meets some of those recommendations from that 2017 report. There would be a purpose statement and also an analysis of the impact and effect of an R&D credit. And this would start for after December. Next one, this certainly would keep Minnesota as a leader, national leader in business innovation and research and development. Minnesota was the first state to do an R&D credit in 1981. This spends basically about $20 million a year on the credit, and it would help about 500 corporations and 100 pass-through businesses would benefit from the research and development expansion. Next, I know Chair Davids is not here today, but this is near and dear to his heart.
Commissioner Marquardt, Lead Gomez has a question.
Sorry, I guess I just wanted to say something real quick about the R&D credit, and we'll talk more about it, I know. And when the commissioner was the chair of tax committee, my very first year, it had to have been in our first month that we received the Office of the Legislative Auditor's report on this tax. And lucky for everybody, I left my copy of the report back in my office, so I won't be quoting from it extensively. But my recollection basically is that the OLA said it's ill-defined, its intent is ill-defined. If it is what we think it is, which is, or if the intent of the effort is what we think it is, to, you know, create and maintain jobs in Minnesota, it does not pay for itself. It goes to C corps mostly. It goes mostly to the largest corporations that pay taxes in Minnesota, and so, you know, there were numerous kind of issues with it. And so, you know, it's, if anybody who's been in taxes for a few years, anytime this comes up, I kind of get on my soapbox about it, because, you know, I agree that we need to be really careful with public dollars. and whether the recipients of public dollars are, you know, Medicaid recipients or the biggest corporations in the world, we got to be concerned about that. So this one in particular, the benefits of it do go to large corporations. Whether it causes them to engage in activities that they wouldn't otherwise engage in is not well defined. It's kind of, that's a difficult measure to meet. But, you know, I just have concern about this being the thing that we want to do for business this year in the governor's budget in the tax area, because none of our Main Street businesses, whether they're in South Minneapolis or in your districts, benefit from this. This is really just targeted toward large business, and certainly, you know, we can differ about what we think the role of the government is and what we think the role of public dollars are in kind of, you know, spurring them to do things. But this just is kind of, it's to me in a moment when we are looking at a major budget deficit, I think that we need to be looking at expenditures on corporate tax credits really critically. Finally, you know, just the idea that we would reinstate refundability of 25% of this credit. What that means is that even if a large corporation has hired their awesome accountant and figured out how to have zero tax liability in Minnesota, even though they would be, you know, using our public services, benefiting from our excellent workforce, benefiting from our education system, benefiting from all the public investments that we all pay for, even if they had figured out how to have no tax liability, what we would do is we would send them a check under this proposal, a check that is of public money collected from taxpayers. And I think that, you know, this, there are, there's a, you know, the, there are a couple of corporate tax credits that are refundable, but that is an unusual design element of a corporate tax credit. And I think that we need to look really critically at that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Rep. Uokim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to echo Co-Chair Gomez's comments about the research and development credit being refundable. That is very worrisome. And I want to thank her for her work on the TAC expenditure working group and everybody that participated, because it is good to look at things every now and then to see if they're working or if they're working as intended. And we do taxes for a few different things. One is to pay for things that we need in our state, like our roads and our education system. The other is to drive behavior. And if you're trying to use a tax and the behavior that you're trying to drive isn't happening, you have to look at it again. I was very excited. I have I know a business owner that's developed two different companies in the state. And I asked them, which drove your behavior to spur on new innovations and new development and hire new people? Was it the angel investor credit or was the research and development credit? And they didn't even have to take a beat. It was the angel investor credit. They said, oh, the research and development credit, I just assume I'm going to get. So I don't do anything with that. I just take it. So I was happy that we expanded the angel investor credit in 23-24. I'd like to see us maybe do something more with that instead of refunding 25% of a credit. So thank you.
Representative Weiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To say that the R&D credit wouldn't affect businesses in our area, rural Minnesota, that's not accurate. There are businesses in our area, and one in particular, that produces lasers, laser cutting equipment, and their biggest competition is overseas. So what they have to do is compete against the overseas markets, and that tax credit directly affects them. It helps them. It puts them on a competitive edge. So to say that this has no effect in our areas, that's not quite accurate. And it does, this is not a big business. This is not a huge corporation. This is a family-run business with, if I recall correctly, under 20 employees that does amazing work, who would directly benefit. It would keep jobs in our area, and it would give them the opportunity to expand and compete against those global markets that are really tough right now. So this does have an impact on our main streets. Thank you.
Any other questions? Kate? Commissioner Marquardt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So basically on the attachment and the purchases, we're moving definition of distribution systems replaces attachments and appurtenances. So it includes metering and street lighting and some of those things. So we've had this to the half yard line many years and unable to get it across. So we will see. The next one, a personal property exemption for low income housing tenants, has to do with the Alliance case that said that an institution of purely public charity is now tax exempt of its real property. And what that does is that if that becomes exempt from real property, all the tenants and lessees all of a sudden are subject to personal property taxes. And you might say, well, why would that be? Well, think about the University of Minnesota, which is not taxable, and they got a Caribou coffee on there. You wouldn't expect them not to be taxable. So that's kind of where the law. So what this does is just says that in these situations, the person who is leasing or renting would not have to pay this personal property tax. So it's kind of a first step in the process. The bottom line is we don't want those tenants in this low-income housing to all of a sudden have to, and you wouldn't just pay a rent, or at least it then would be set at actually the market value of the property there that you're leasing. So this would solve that, but we know there's probably more work yet to be done with this one. Landlord penalty for failure to submit CRPs. Right now, landlord does not submit CRP in a timely manner, which is January 31st, to the tenant. It's a $100 fine. Now with the new law and with the renter's refund becoming a renter's credit on the income tax form, you now have to, landlord has to send a CRP also to the Department of Revenue. So now it's $50 fine to revenue and $50 for not sending it to the tenant. So it remains at $100. It's just spent for not doing both of those. So, and this is all electronic. I will tell you, we had a number of phone calls we dealt with as we were working with landowners on this and getting this completed and so forth, but we think we're working through most of it. New corporate franchise tax division pass-through audit. Partnerships are becoming more complex. There's partnerships, partnerships that own partnerships, and they each have a set of taxpayers and be able to get kind of through those. So it's adding auditors to be able to really kind of look at these more complex business situations. And ultimately, well, it's a cost initially. There would be increased revenue coming in the long term.
Representative Lee.
Sure. I mean, if the commissioner's done explaining this slide, then I can ask my question. Yeah. That. Okay.
Is that fine to take a question now, or do you want to?
Oh, you want, no, either way. No, yeah, I'm done, Mr. Chair, explaining this part. So.
Finley.
Great. Thank you, Chair. So my question is about, you know, starting up this audit, because as I understand it, the crafty and complex pass-through entities that, you know, you're trying to target with this are complex because they're organized across numerous state lines. But also, like, this past week, we've heard a lot of reports about IRS employees who were hired specifically to do the same thing at the federal level being fired or let go or threatened of being fired. They may have been fired already. We're not sure yet. And so I'm just curious, you know, how does this maybe hinder efforts to start up this new audit office? Or, you know, if you don't get the support you need on the federal level, what does this do to our auditors on the state level? Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Commissioner Marquardt.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lee, so as far as this audit unit, I don't know if there's going to be a big impact either which way from the federal government. We talked about the federal government. I'm actually more concerned when we talk about that voluntary compliance part where, where you have, you know, the kind of this bedrock principle of having your data secure and that. I'm more concerned about that than probably what this auditing situation would be. I don't right now see what if there would be a correlation or an impact on that.
Representative
Lee. Good, thank you.
Commissioner Marquardt.
So next one is Governor, Lieutenant Governor's proposals to repeal the K through 12. Oh, did I miss one? Oh, we're on a short, okay, I've got a little different. Short line railroad infrastructure, there was a credit up to 50% for reconstruction or replacement expenditures. You could transfer or sell the credit, but you had to wait to the end of the tax year. This now allows you to do that immediately. And now back to, okay, so then the repeal of the K through 12 education credit assignment. So this is the only part of the program that changes, the K through 12 education credit. Everything else remains the same, but a little under 1% of the eligible taxpayers were using this assignment where if I am a parent and I find some educational opportunity, I can qualify for a credit up to $1,500. The credit covers three quarters of what that would cost. It's tough for me to pay that $2,000 initially. So I would assign my $1,500 tax credit to a lender. Well, there's been some concerns over that, and folks, when they come to get their tax credit, they haven't qualified because somehow they didn't follow the procedure or something didn't go through, and they're out of that $1,500 that has to be sent to the lender. So this just eliminates that assignment process, but nothing else changes in the program. So Governor's budget recommendation, here's repeal the tax filing modernization account, which Representative Elkins had talked about before. The legislature back in 2023 authorized $5 million to look at direct file. The Department of Revenue has been working on that. Our biggest concern at the Department of Revenue has been we want to make sure that we get this started, that it's of high quality to the taxpayer and that we do it right. And there's a couple areas of concern. First of all, it works best if we can stay aligned with the federal direct file program, which has, I think, 24 states right now doing that. But I think there's some uncertainty on the federal level right now of continuing it into the future. I know this year the Treasury Secretary said for sure, but there's some questions moving on. And then just ongoing funding from the legislature would be key. But I will say that we just recently had some Vita sites that had some problems getting some federal funding, and they provide free tax service to residents. And so the equation could very well be changing on this because, if Vita sites are having problems, a need for direct file certainly increases. And the Department of Revenue certainly is very open to a direct file, but we just would really want to make sure we get this right for the taxpayer. And so we're always looking at the federal government and always looking at ongoing funding also, but very open to doing this direct file if all things could fall into place. Next, reduce sustainable forest incentive payments by 30%. Saves about $5 million a year. Repeal the local government cannabis aid. Out of the 10% gross receipts tax for cannabis sales, 20% of that would go to local governments, cities, and counties. There were no payouts to cities because there weren't any registered cannabis dealers, but there was 183,000 that went out to counties. What this would do is eliminate that, which saves about $13 million in the first biennium and $32 million in the second. Part of the governor, lieutenant governor's thoughts on this is that cities and counties since 2019 have received $110 million of increased local government aid, $110 million of increased county program aid. And so those certainly are not touched in the budget, but this is one area to find some savings.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner Marquardt. My understanding was the reason they were giving this money to the local governments was because the local governments are going to bear a lot of the enforcement responsibilities. So can you talk about, you know, did they consider that when they were coming up with this proposal or how they want to address that? Thank you.
Yeah. Mr. Chair and Representative Robbins, so, you know, is going back to my statement with the increase in the local government aid, the local government aid and county program aid can be its general purpose aid. So that can be used for enforcement, certainly in this case, on cannabis also. So that was part of the consideration, is that there has been the increase in funding that can be used for any purpose, including this one, enforcement on the cannabis.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Interesting that you mentioned that the increase of local government, local program aid. Did you also mention the increased mandates that keep going down to the county, that local program aid is actually there to take care of or overcompensate? So are we saying we're going to start increasing local program aid, or are we going to start reducing some of these mandates if you think it's so easy for the counties to bypass or not use this money for the cannabis? It bothers me, coming from the county, that the state sees counties as piggy banks, that if whatever you need to do or need more money, you just put more mandates down to them without their agreeing to it, and then just figure, oh, well, they're just going to come up with the services somehow. There's going to be some issues down there with cannabis, and I think it was very smart at the time when the money was brought down to, or was the wisdom that was there to see there's going to be issues at the city and the county that are going to have to be dealt with. And I just think now, which seems to happen, is all this was good, we got this passed, we got this bill passed, everybody feels good, the city's taking care of, the county's being taken care of. Now that maybe nobody is paying attention, let's take that money back and let's use it for something else. Mm-hmm. I mean, when is a tax cut not a tax cut? It's when you just make somebody else raise their taxes. It's still a tax. So I think it's very, I know, irresponsible of the governor to be trying to play shell games with people and standing there and saying your taxes are being lowered, but don't come talk to us when all of a sudden your levies go up again, another percent or two or three. I guess I'm just curious why, you know, why it is viewed that the counties don't need the money. They don't need that program aid, that it's already lowering levies, that it's preventing from skyrocketing levies, that all these other mandates don't need to be taken care of. It just frustrates me when we sit up here, I guess I'm up here now, sit up here and tell the counties that you really don't need this money, or we just gonna have you do the services now that we originally started, but we don't want to pay for, so now you have to. How does that make sense? Or why do you feel the counties are flush with cash that they can automatically take this down? And it's not because of county program aid, I can tell you that. That's all spent and used by mandates that already been put down there. So, thank you, Chair.
Rep. Stevenson. Did you have a question, Representative? Or Commissioner Marquardt, do you want to respond to that?
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, the governor cares very much about counties. In fact, before 2019, when the Governor Walz was governor, it used to always be 2-1 LGA to CPA, 2-1. It was like, you know, if you remember, it was 564 to like 264 or 234 or something. And it was Governor Walz who said, now, if we're going to give out LGA and CPA, it's going to be equal. And so in 2019, it was 30 apiece, and in 2023, it was 80 apiece, where in years past, it would have been 80-40. In fact, I was guilty of doing that a few times myself. So he cares very much about that. The one thing with this is no dollars other than $183,000 of the counties had been dished out at all yet on this. So, you know, if you're going to look at local government aid or county program aid, you're looking for some savings there. This was maybe the area to go because no funding had gone out yet. And you could still use those dollars.
Representative.
That's true. No funding went out. But from the last I read the paper, the cannabis hasn't really moved forward yet, except for a few locations. So the need for those services weren't necessarily
right
in place either.
Right.
So I think we have to also take that into account that, yeah, they didn't receive the money, but they didn't have the cost there either. And now they're going to receive the cost and not the money. So now it's another item that they're going to have to figure out where that money's going to come from. So thank you.
Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a comment. There, when we passed the cannabis bill, we did include this program, but it's not the only funding that local governments are able to access through the cannabis bill. They have the ability to charge cannabis businesses licensing fees, and there were other aspects of the cannabis bill that spent money that goes down to state and local governments. Most significantly, I'm thinking of funding of local public health departments, but also funding for training of drug recognition experts that went to local law enforcement agents that was really significant. There were any number of different line items that go to local governments. And all of this, despite the fact that cities and counties play a very minor role in our state's cannabis regulation scheme. They have no role at all in licensing, and their role in regulating cannabis businesses is very, very minimal. They have to check retail businesses once a year, maybe twice a year, to make sure they're not selling to people under the age of 21, but that's really about it. I don't know that, and again, they already do get to charge a licensing fee to defray those costs. There's also other avoided costs as a result of the cannabis bill in the public safety space, you know, from not having to do certain police work and prosecution work. So I just wanted to correct the record that it is not a situation where the state is requiring cities and counties to do a whole bunch of thing, a whole bunch of work in the cannabis space and no longer picking up the tab. Cities and counties have almost no role in regulating cannabis under the law that was passed in 2023.
Commissioner Marquardt.
Mr. Chair and members, the last item is reducing the aquatic invasive species aid, which goes out to counties by $5 million. So, Mr. Chair, that's Governor's budget. Thank you so much for allowing me to present that.
Thank you, Commissioner Marquardt. And like Davey said, we will be doing more of a deep dive into the governor's budget as it gets, and look forward to all the discussions. Any other business? Next meeting is on Thursday, and with that, I will adjourn.